Hey, I'm Eric Thornburg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Emmett Shear. Emmett is the co-founder and CEO of Twitch.tv, before that Justin TV, and is a part-time investing partner at Y Combinator. This episode, we go into the story of Twitch.tv, how it spun out of Justin TV, how he's learned being a CEO over time and scaling a company. We talk about how he became a YC partner, and then we have a broader talk about capitalism, social inequality, and how technology can reduce it. Emmett is the rare combo of a strong CEO operator and also at the same time a very deep thinker. Enjoy chatting with him, and I hope you will too. All right. What encouraged you to join YC as a part-time partner?
Paul emailed me and he was like, do you want to be a part-time partner because you're involved? And I was like, well, YC, basically, YC is an incredibly formative part of my education as an entrepreneur. It's like, I think I credit YC with like why I would like became successful ever. Like, I don't know if I would, maybe would have been successful anyways, I have no idea, but like YC certainly accelerated it. And like, so the chance to give back and like be part of that organization, like, who says no to that?
I don't know.
I would have to be so busy that I could not possibly find the time to do it.
Yeah.
And I found that actually just getting to talk to that many founders, getting to see that many companies, has been really educational for me. And it's actually like, I think it's like, it's more than paid back the
right
effort that goes into it.
Yeah. Interesting. You've been at the live video space for almost 10 years?
Yeah, since 2007.
And the almost all of the original team is now YC partners?
So you've got Justin is full-time partner.
Yeah.
Michael's full-time partner. Kyle, I'm a part-time partner. Kyle is full-time running his a startup, so they just started. So I don't think he's not working for YC. I don't think he has time.
Right. So how do you kind of make sense of like looking 8 years, you know, what do you think when you look back to that time?
I mean, so when we first got started on Justin TV, we had a year and a half of experience. Like we really didn't.
You're like 23 years old?
Yeah. We like did not know what we were doing. Which is fine. I think most successful companies are trying to be people who don't know what they're doing when they start. Like knowing what you're doing empirically seems to be something of a disadvantage. I mean, not entirely. Like there's certainly kinds of companies, and there's companies that are people who are very experienced and know exactly what they're doing. But I think if you haven't maintained, there's two ways to have a beginner's mind. One is to be such an expert that you can like achieve beginner's mind on purpose, and the other is just to be really ignorant.
Yeah.
And like we went with the just really ignorant path to having that beginner's mind for startups. And I worry sometimes now. Like, I don't think I could start a startup in the live video space at least again,
right?
Because I know too much.
Yeah.
Like too much. I have too many beliefs and too. I know I'm too aware of all the pitfalls to charge ahead blindly into the unknown. I think that that's a common problem people have. In retrospect, I wish I'd been much more experienced as a manager when I got started. I wish I'd been more experienced programmer. I think being a little ignorant on the business side is actually an advantage. Because it prevents you from getting trapped in what everyone already knows. Because the successful startups always upend something everyone already knows. If it was obvious to everyone, there were already startups doing it, and like you would already have a massive competitive market, and we're already seizing the opportunity. Like almost by definition, startups have to have something about them that looks wrong in the beginning. And so the more experienced you are, the more likely you are to notice that's wrong and refuse to do the startup because this clearly can't work.
Mm-hmm.
And then you don't start the successful company.
Do you have another swing at bat in you?
I mean, not right now.
Yeah, no, but as you think about the future.
Maybe, I don't know. There's two good reasons to start a startup. One reason to start a startup is because you want the experience, you want to do that, you want to run your own company, you want to be able to make the decisions at that level. And the fastest route to be able to make really the strategic decisions about the future of a product is to start your own company. That's like, by definition, you get to make all those calls. And so really, that really draws you if you really want to do that and you want to be the person who has to make those calls and gets to make those calls, you should start a company. But the other reason to do it is because there's some particular product that you really believe in, that you want to exist, that needs to exist, and you're gonna go make it. That's more of a destination than a journey, but like, you know, they're both valid reasons to go start a startup. And for me, I already have the first one. Like, there's no reason to go. If I want to be involved at a strategic level, I'm already involved. Like, there's not, yeah. I'm not gonna get more involved at a strategic level than I already am. It's possible that there'll be some idea I have where I'm just like, this is like, it's so compelling, it has to exist. I need to go make that happen. But again, I think one of the reasons why there's so few serial entrepreneurs is because when you get up to the edge of trying to start another company after you've already started one and like gone through that pathway, you can see in front of you all the pain you're about to take on. Like, starting a company is really painful. There's a lot of work. There's a lot of, I mean, when we were getting started, there's a lot of 7-day weeks. There's a lot of never turning it off. And that doesn't last forever, right? That's a temporary thing when you're trying to get something off the ground and when every hour you don't spend working on it means it's not going anywhere.
Right.
But the idea of jumping back into something which is going to cause you that much stress when you don't have to, it becomes less appealing. So I think that's one reason why you see a lot of people who start companies exactly once.
As an investor, do you have a stance on first-time founders versus second versus?
No, I mean, I think you just have to judge every startup individually as an investor. I think that trying to have rules as an investor is a good way to miss great opportunities, because for any rule you can make up for me, I bet I can come up with a counterexample when that was wrong and you missed the $1 billion company because you had some stupid rule that isn't actually a rule. Mm-hmm. It's just a heuristic. And if you apply all the rules really, if you have come with a bunch of rules, what will happen is you're going to filter out all the really bad companies. You're probably going to filter out most of the really good companies too, and you're going to left with a bunch of stuff in the middle, which I guess can be fine. There's actually a whole strategy around trying to pick not the big winners, but like the ones in the middle. But like, I don't know. I don't find that very appealing. And I also think that I don't think rules would help you do that. I think you have to. I don't think there's a substitute in investing for just judgment. And you know, that's, it's sort of a, and Ben Horne says this thing, where he's talking about products, but I think it applies to investing too. There's no silver bullet to investing, just a lot of lead bullets. It's the same thing, you know, product is that way 100%. Like, there's no like magic answer to product, just a lot. You do it the hard way, mm-hmm. and the only way to be successful at investing is also the hard way. Like, think really hard, come up with the correct answer. Right, what's that? I think that's a Feynman thing, right? Mm-hmm. This method for solving any problem, read problem. Think very hard. Write down the answer. I mean, kind of, yeah. Like, there's a little more to it than that. But like, that's all there is to investing, right? Like, look at company, think hard, decide whether you invest or not. Like, I don't think you can go. I don't think you can make any rule that's more hard and fast than that. It's really going to work every time.
Is there a dating equivalent?
No. Actually, dating is very different. I think dating. What I've discovered about dating, I'm married now.
I'm asking for a friend.
Yeah, what I've said about dating now is that dating is all about trying to be authentically you and not and honest with your intentions and your feelings and like whether you care about the other person or not, and being very kind in the process and like hoping that it comes out well. I think trying to approach dating from a optimization problem solving standpoint tends to be pathological. Mm-hmm. It tends to create pathological relationships that don't actually make you happy. And so I think you should treat it very differently than how you start a startup or do an investment.
That's refreshing. Elaborate on the pathological part.
Oh, just that like if you're reducing the other person to a collection of plus minus traits that like. And you're trying to sort of decide on your time investments based on some sort of like judgment of like, okay, we're going to think about all these like attributes of the person. You're like ignoring the person.
Yeah.
And I think that means creates this relationship that's about, that's very transactional. It's very much about, okay, I give this, you give that. And we're like making a trade. And I'm a huge capitalist. I believe in trade. I think trade is the right way to run the economy, but not maybe the right way to run your interpersonal relationships.
Yeah.
And so, because when you just run by trade, suddenly it's like, it breaks that system of when they're down or when you're down, suddenly, and you don't have that much to offer for 6 months, for a year, for 2 years, because your life sucks for some reason. It creates a situation where, like, why am I still in this relationship? What am I getting out of this? And being self-focused in that way is good when you're trying to make a decision about a business, but it's very bad. I think it's very bad for your relationship. I don't think it leads to happiness. Being happiness is about caring about them, not yourself.
Do you think that it's fascinating that the way we work economically trains the way we work interpersonally, and how can people have such a, like, clear separation or opposing, you know, philosophies? And
I think there's spillover. I mean, there's always spillover. There's spillover interpersonally for how the revenue around your personal relationship spills over inside the company, to how you treat employees, how you treat your peers, and hopefully how you treat your boss too, like how you treat the other people in the company who you have to interact with. And I think that actually post the hiring process, and outside of, like, being pretty cold-blooded about performance reviews, you should interact with people in the company fundamentally from a place of kindness, just because that otherwise you're going to think this company, it's just not a pleasant place to work. And there's a balance there, but I think that also spill over from, you know, you live in a transactional world all the time.
Yeah.
You tend to start treating your personal relationships that way. But I don't know. I think that I have a very different kind of interpersonal relationship. Humans are capable of containing more than one model in their head for how to interact with people, and I think it's about it's just contextual. You learn that in one context this is an appropriate behavior, in another context this is a not appropriate behavior. I think the dangerous thing that happens these days is just that the context changed so rapidly. What is the right relationship with an Airbnb host?
Right.
Right? Like, it's very clear with a hotel concierge that it's a transactional relationship. But Airbnb is, like, it's halfway in between an actual personal relationship and a formalized business relationship. And I think we're still, as a society, these things come up a lot, and we're still trying to figure it out.
And the whole sharing economy, right?
Yeah, the whole sharing economy is like that. Or internet dating, right?
Yeah.
Internet dating tends to reduce people to a collection of attributes in a way that I think is not necessarily great, but on the other hand, it's a really effective way to, like, match people, because you got to go on something, and you
right.
can't communicate your whole being over, which actually I think is why Tinder has been so popular, because, okay, yes, it does at some level reduce you to a picture, but actually what it just says is sort of like, don't think too hard, yes, no, and that's like that's something that does, in fact, that resonates with people, because it doesn't set you up before you start talking to the person first. Like, the major mode of interaction on Tinder is, like, you're going to chat with them. And, like, of course you can abuse that, but, like, I think that's good. I think actually the trend, that's the right way to, I think there's a reason why Tinder's been so successful, and it's that that's a better way to actually establish a connection with someone than trying to just, you know, list off
yeah.
facts about yourself. I forgot the question.
Talk about me too, but this is just fascinating trail of thought. What makes you a diehard capitalist, and what critiques of capitalism that might seem reasonable do you disagree with?
So I'm a diehard capitalist because the capitalist system, the perfect frictionless capitalist economy is almost by definition the most productive economy, that produces the most wealth for society. And your goal when you're designing, therefore, an economy or a societal system is to build something that approximates that reality, that theoretical reality, as closely as possible. And so that means you're sort of starting from that as the base. That's the capitalist system, to the degree that it's possible, should be the base, because if any time you try to restrain something away from that sort of theoretical system, you can sort of show how that inevitably leads to price distortions, which cause misallocation of resources away from their optimal place in society. Now, the thing is, the real world doesn't have perfect information, doesn't have perfect competition, doesn't have immediate, infinite flexibility in price changes. And there's been a ton of work by economists that sort of shows all the ways in which the real world necessarily diverges from this perfect theoretical capitalist system. I think one of the most sort of near my heart and obvious examples where capitalism breaks down really badly actually is tuna. Like, you have these tuna in the ocean that don't belong to anyone. There's no property right in the tuna. And trying to establish a property right in the tuna is like very difficult because like they range over vast segments of the ocean. We can't really track the fish on an individual basis. They're not in any one country's area. Even if they were, how do you say who owns which fish in the ocean? Because you can't farm them.
Right.
So the system breaks, actually, because all of a sudden, capitalism assumes there's no such thing as an unowned resource, right? There's like that's almost an axiom of a perfect capitalist system. You don't have common resources because those should, in any sensible capitalist system, be immediately consumed and turned into property. And so, so I guess the way I see, like, so Maine had this problem with lobsters, similar to the tuna problem, where they're being overfished and all the tuna are dying. Well, we were overfishing the lobsters and there are fewer and fewer lobsters every year. People had to work harder and harder to fish less and less lobster. And they basically said, okay, we're going to hand out medallions that say each medallion is your right to X percent of the total lobster catch this year. And we'll set the lobster catch by the sustainable level. Some scientist is going to go say, okay, we can catch 20,000 lobsters this year. You go catch those lobsters, and then anyone who's poaching lobsters, though, medallion will throw in jail. And that was super effective. That, like, the lobster populations rebounded, you had to do less work to, it was the classic tragedy, we fixed the tragedy of the commons by basically creating a property right in the lobsters. I view that as inherently, while it is an you could say, okay, that's government regulation. I actually think that what the goal there is, you're taking this thing that's broken because it doesn't approximate the capitalist economy, and because we live in this real world, not this purely theoretical
right.
world, and you're moving it in a way so that it kind of better approximate that theoretical, beautiful world where everything has a property right and trade, and everything has freedom of trade, etc., etc. Same reason why I generally support a single payer healthcare system, because in theory, everyone just buys healthcare and it's a free trade system, blah, 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 blah. But in practice, many people get randomly hit by massive medical care bills, and you have this sort of like, in a perfect capitalist system, all of the actors don't like randomly get sick for no reason in a totally unequal and unfair way. Everyone starts on the same sort of basis. And so you're trying to move back into a system that allows people to participate more fully in that capitalist economy in action and be in that world where all trades are made because this is the rational trade for you to make at this moment. And so I think there's a lot of critiques of capitalism which say it's sort of intrinsically unfair that capitalism produces inequality, because capitalism, no doubt, produces inequality. And I just, like, am not bothered by the inequality. I don't think there's anything wrong with inequality except that to a degree, it winds up pushing you away from that ideal capitalist economy, which it does. If you're at the bottom end of the inequality scale, if you really don't have enough, your life no longer approximates anything that looks like capitalism. Your life now approximates, I have no choice but to keep this job, because if I don't have this job for 2 weeks, I get kicked out of my house, and then I get into a downward spiral, and my life goes to shit.
Right.
And that's not what that is not the beautiful, shining theoretical capitalist system. That's broken. And so that kind of inequality is like bothers me a lot. But I also just don't think I don't really think there are very many coherent critiques of the idea that in general people should be free to trade. You give almost anyone you have people who have these luxuries no one needs to survive, that no one really, diamonds or whatever, and they're being produced in a non-exploitative manner, they're not destroying the environment as they do them, there's no externality, we're positing this commodity with no externalities that's purely a luxury. It's hard to see I've never heard anyone give a coherent reason why that shouldn't be allocated to whoever is willing to pay the most for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it shouldn't be freely traded to whoever wants it. It's the fact that every commodity varies in some way away from that perfect theoretical commodity that means you need regulation.
What do you believe about inequality that other people don't that make you think it's not that bad?
So I think that inequality becomes dangerous when you have concentrations, because wealth doesn't stay in the capitalist system. It goes outside of it into the political system. That does, in fact, become a problem. But generally speaking, if you know Warren Buffett has $50 billion sitting in a bunch of companies, it's hard to see how the fact that in a ledger somewhere written down that's all under his name matters all that much. Because what is the bad consequence you anticipate from him having this massive concentration of wealth? So it's unclear what bad. I haven't heard a direct, like, okay, him having his name written down next to that thing in a book somewhere is somehow damaging to other people. The companies don't really change as a result. In fact, that's the whole philosophy of that. The danger comes, of course, when you have concentrations of wealth, when that can be starts becoming used to because economic wealth can become political power, and then you get regulatory capture, and you get all kinds of other distortions of the capitalist system that are bad. And I actually see inequality is bad when it starts to impact the capitalist system directly. I don't know. I don't necessarily think I disagree with people that like inequality is a is it. I disagree with the idea that inequality is a terminal problem. That there's some reason to believe, to not like inequality inherently. The world isn't necessarily equal. That's fine. It's not. I'm not damaged by someone having more than me. But it can be bad in an instrumental way. You can draw chains of causality that show, okay, we have this inequality and it leads to this bad consequence. Okay, well, how do we cut that bad consequence off? In one way, maybe we have to reduce the inequality. Another way, it might be we make a rule about how you use your wealth, or how you pass your wealth to your children or something, and that fixes the problem instead.
Wouldn't some people say that they judge their kind of happiness based on relative wealth?
If you're judging your happiness based on the rat race of who has more than who else, you will never be happy.
Right.
Like, happiness is about being happy with what you have, not about. And there's like lots of research that, well, up to a point, there's certain lack of wealth that will in fact cause unhappiness, but past a certain point, and not a particularly high point, having more stuff or less stuff is not the thing that makes you happy.
So you wouldn't say you're interested in reducing inequality. You're more interested in just raising, making sure everyone's at a certain point.
Yeah.
Are you to what end or what capacity are you interested? Is it universal income? Is it?
I think this basic income is a really interesting proposal. It has a lot of practical issues in trying to implement something like basic income. I think that without going quite that far, although I think that's, you know, it's an interesting idea, and I'd love to see a practically designed proposal for actually doing it that, and I'd love to see an experiment where we tried it somewhere. Mm-hmm. If you could solve the like adverse selection problem of people moving out. I think it's more important to focus on for solving that in, you know, the sort of the low end problem. Does everyone have access to basic things they need, right? Housing, medical care, and those things. And the way you make those things, actually, you drop the prices, right? You make those cheap. You find a way to make those cheaper. And how do you make housing cheaper? It's like trivially obvious how you make housing cheaper. You make more housing. I mean, you can try to pass laws about making housing cost less money all you want, but all that will do is create shortages and queues. You can't, it's incompressible. You can't get around the fact that to house more people more cheaply, you need to build more housing more cheaply. It's a principled economic reality. And that's why I favor, you know, finding ways to build lots more housing that is affordable, which means building lots more housing as the ground truth to make that happen. Finding ways to make healthcare produce lots more. It's all about producing, right? So producing a lot more healthcare more cheaply, which is why I love, there's a lot of healthcare startups I think are really exciting, because they're trying to drive down the cost of providing healthcare. There's a one in San Francisco, it's like a, called Care Practice, and in some ways it's expensive because they don't take health insurance, but in some ways it's really cheap because they cut out this massive amount of bureaucracy. Their full payment is not much more than my co-payment through other services, and that's like kind of crazy, but it turns out you can in fact do things that greatly reduce the cost of these essential goods, and that's really the most important thing, is how do we bring that within everyone's reach by driving down the cost of goods. I mean, the single best thing that's happened for poor people in the past 200 years is that the Green Revolution, making food dirt cheap. Like, if you look at the cost of food 100 years ago versus now, food is, like, almost free. Like, mm-hmm. we've almost created a basic human right to food just by driving the price down so much that almost anyone can afford calories.
But yeah, aren't there tons of people that are starving? Or?
Well, malnourished, maybe. Not starving anymore. I mean, starving would be... Starving in America is hard. There are very few people who actually starve. Malnourishment, serious problem, but that's more about... that's more about just gross inequality where you, at the level of, like, other things are eating up my income to the point where, like, I also can't afford food on top of rent and healthcare and these other things. Food itself makes up a tiny, even for very poor people, food makes up a tiny percentage of your budget, right? It's these other costs that are screwing you, the rent cost. And the thing that you can be most flexible on is, right, you have to have a place to stay. Once you've got that, you can't, like, decide to take 10% less, I'll take 10% less square footage this month to make ends meet, unfortunately, right? I'll take 10% less healthcare this month to make ends meet. Can't do that. I'll eat 10% less food and be malnourished. That happens, which is why malnourishment still exists. But if you look at, you know, if you look at the average budget, food costs are, like, that's not the problem. It's everything else.
Would you consider yourself a techno optimist?
Yeah, I think in general, I think that I'm a techno optimist in the sense that I think that if there are solutions to these problems, technology will be a big part of it. Because the fact that these things seem within reach of being solved by social programs today, which I think they are, I think there are political solutions to these problems today, rather than technological ones, is because of technological progress. 200 years ago, it wasn't just that we needed better social programs, we really actually did need to make food cheaper. There was no way to get everyone what they wanted with the technology of 200 years ago. And I think that's true for healthcare today. Like, there's a fundamental problem in healthcare that it's just not cheap enough. And I am a technological optimist from that standpoint, because I believe that technology is making us more and more productive, and that it will drive down the costs of healthcare. It will drive down the cost of rent. It will drive, well, at least certain kinds of rent.
Right.
Maybe not waterfront property, but, like, these things are amenable to being fixed. Transportation will get cheaper, right? Uber is doing that right now. It's driving the price of transportation down, and those trends will continue, and that's, like, ultimately is what's going to enable us to have political solutions to these problems. I mean, it requires both, but
yeah.
The trends all seem like they're going in a good direction. Look at solar power, right? The price of solar power has fallen by just absurd amount over the last 15 years. And it's competitive with coal now, and it'll be competitive with gas soon. And, you know, that's great. It's nice to live in that world.
Are you concerned, or does there need to be a system of ethics underlying techno-optimism, or is something beyond the market?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are places where smart people seem concerned, myself included, not the smart people, but I'm also included in the people who are concerned, that there are things you can develop technologically that are very dangerous, right? I think, you know, synthetic biology is particularly terrifying in this way, that, you know, if I could synthesize smallpox in my basement with an off-the-shelf, you know, virus synthesizer, like, we live in a very scary and dangerous world all of a sudden there, and making and distributing components that are capable of synthesizing, you know, weaponized smallpox, maybe not a good idea. Like, maybe we shouldn't do that. That's, like, something that, like, we should consider, like, just having laws against,
right,
allowing people to have that kind of, or at least tightly regulating who's allowed to have access to that equipment, because that's terrifying. The hands, you know, that kind of stuff in the hands of someone who wants to wreak, to do harm, it only takes one. It doesn't take, you know, large numbers of people to make that a problem. And it's worse than the kind of, you know, bomb, you know, blowing things up with bombs, because, yes, blowing things up with bombs are very tragic and very sad and horrible, but it's not going to wipe out a third of a country.
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's have a sense of scale here. That's way more terrifying. And so I think that, I think there's lots of areas like that. And then you sort of have a two-pronged approach there. One is you just have to directly control access to building that kind of equipment and, you know, where it gets distributed to. And then also, I think there's an inevitable future of surveillance that's going to be somewhat necessary, where you're looking for telltale signs.
Future of aliens?
Yeah, exactly. Where you're Is it Future Valence? Minority Report style?
I think it's Aliens.
Oh, no, no.
Surveillance?
Surveillance. like Minority Report style.
Yes, okay.
Like, it's scary, and I don't really want the government to come arrest me for a crime I'm going to commit. But as these technologies become more and more advanced, the only way to figure out, at some point, the only way we're going to know who's about to kill us all with smallpox is to be looking for precursor signs of that behavior that are telltales about who they're talking to and what, you know. And, like, hopefully we can design a society and a system where that doesn't turn into, oh, you're just thrown in jail, like, there's no trial, you're just thrown in jail, like, because some computer system said you look like you were dangerous. But rather, that's used as a successfully used as a trigger to actually do police work and actually investigate, and then throw you in jail if you actually were doing it. But I think without that kind of, you know, we do, by the time you're trying to play defense, like, I'm not a techno-optimist when it comes to weapon systems.
Have you seen Black Mirror, by the way?
I haven't. Okay. It's really good. I really want to watch it.
But yeah.
The offense is getting better faster than the defense is getting better, mm-hmm. right? Like, we can, the technology required to build synthetic smallpox viruses is simpler than the technology required to upgrade our immune systems to become immune to those weaponized smallpox viruses. It is not balanced. The offense has a big advantage, and we cannot rely on fighting it with at the point where someone actually, once the weapon is released, once the bad thing has happened, it is definitely too late. We have to catch these things well before that point, because the offense versus defense equation is just totally unbalanced.
Wait, I'm gonna tie this all back in. Do you believe in charter cities?
I think charter cities are an interesting idea. I believe in experimentation, is what I would say. I believe that we would be much better served as a world, as a country, you know, at any scale, by having some systematic way to evaluate people's proposals that is not having a bunch of people argue about whether or not it's a good idea. Because the history of, like, in science, of, like, arguing about whether or not a particular theory is true or not is not particularly great.
Mm.
Arguing about these theories seems to generate mostly argument and not a lot of clarity or, like, good decision-making. So if we can find a way to try a policy and have the answer to be, is this policy a good idea? I don't know. Let's just try it and find out what happens. That would be immensely powerful because that shifts policymaking out of the realm of, you know, theorizing, which is intrinsically fraught, especially something that complex, and into the realm where we can actually, you know, let's have 10 cities and 5 of them we're going to have a control group and we're going to have 5 of them try it and 5 of them not and see what happens. And, like, that would be great. Are charter cities the right way to solve that problem? I'm, like, kind of skeptical because I think charter cities wind up being, I have my set of theories and I want to go make my theories real and I'm just going to go take my ball and go make this charter city that, like, does my theories. And I'm kind of in favor of them anyways because I think that, like, at least those theories are outside the mainstream and it becomes some kind of experimental evidence at some level. You know, in a Bayesian sense, it becomes evidence that that policy is either better or worse than the surrounding policies or that collection of policies is anyway, since they're not going to just change one thing at a time, which is also irritating. But I'm not a really huge believer in charter cities. I don't think they fundamentally shift the way, the problem is the way we make the policy, not the policies we enact. The policies we enact are just an inevitable consequence of the fact that we're making it up and we're not actually testing anything. So that was the idea behind the United States, right? The laboratory of the states, all this, you know, this very weak central government that enforces some basic rules about trade and motion, and then the states would make their own rules, and we'd see what happens, and that would be how we'd make policy decisions, it's kind of a very compelling vision that lasted approximately zero years before it was not true anymore. I don't know if there's ever been a society where we've actually been willing to allow, we're willing to allow that level of experimentation because it means allowing your neighboring state to do something you think is, like, morally wrong. Like, usually this triggers very deep beliefs. Like, you're cutting off all aid to poor people entirely and replacing it with, like, just this one program. Like, how is, you know, that's so immoral and wrong. How can you do that? And then you want to do something about it. You want to pass a law at the federal level to stop it, which is what we do consistently, right? You're not going to let anyone who wants to smoke marijuana? That's terrible. We can't allow that. We have to pass a law. And, like, if you could somehow create a culture where the thought process was, they're going to do their thing, we're going to do our thing, and then we're going to look at the other what happens, that'd be great. I don't know if that's like actually humanly possible, but that's the direction. To the degree we can create more real-world tests of policy, where we actually see what happens, the better off we are.
And what underlies your philosophy of just belief in experiments? And is it, you know, is it a professional level? You share it on the civic level. Do you also share it on the personal and interpersonal level?
Or yeah, is that where... I'm a huge believer in see what actually happens. I think that it is human nature to want to if every, what I've noticed is it always feels like I'm right. If I have a belief about something, even if it's just based on having theorized about the situation, it feels very much like I am definitely right all the time. But my feeling of how strongly I believe I'm right, I've also noticed, doesn't really correlate all that well to the whether I actually am right or not. What I have noticed, though, is that when I've gone and actually tested it, then it correlates really well with whether I'm right. Then my beliefs become extremely predictive. And so it's just become this point where I'm like, okay, if I don't know, will I be happier if I go swing dancing or not? And I feel like, you know, it's taken me some time to learn this, but like when I go, the best way to answer that question is just go try going swing dancing and see what happens. And obviously you have a limited number of those things you can try, but like being ruthless about try it, give it time, and then if you don't like it, kill it, is a good idea for startups, it's a good idea for your personal life, I think it would be a good idea for governmental policy.
But you were saying earlier when you were talking about relationships that people typically think that, oh, if you're not doing anything giving for me, I should leave.
I'm not talking about, I'm talking less about experimenting with who you should be dating and running a
or even friends
test
with,
on,
yeah.
Or friend, be friends with, and more about, I am friends with this person. Should I, you know, should I make a point of like calling them every day or not? Right. And like, I don't know if that's a good idea. Like, I don't, you can sort of theorize whether that's a good idea for your relationship or not. But the best way to find out if it has an impact is to try it and see what the outcome is.
Elaborate on your theory of happiness that you brought up earlier as it relates to friendships or relationships or just interpersonal.
So,
and how did you come to this philosophy?
I mean, there's a good deal of empirical evidence that having close friends is very important. And like, I think, I don't know, that's one of those things where, of course it came out that way, and duh, but at the same time, there's a lot of science which, when you hear the results, you're like, oh, of course, duh, but actually if you heard the opposite, you would have said the same thing, so I'm glad to have that evidence, but the, you know, having deep, long-term interpersonal relationships is about being committed to actually like reaching out and connecting with that person and being willing to spend time and effort to continue to connect with them even when it's inconvenient to you. In some ways it's funny, it's inherently somewhat selfish, I guess, at some level, because you're using them, but like the only way to make it work is to legitimately actually care about them as people, not just instrumentally as like objects of, I need 5 minutes of social context today. And like if you try to approach it that way, it's not going to work. Yeah. Like you're not going to get the value out. I guess for me, it becomes social context. I intrinsically like connecting with people. I enjoy, as much as I am a little bit, slightly on the autism spectrum maybe, I really do enjoy connecting with people and getting to know them, especially people that, you know, and you click with some people, you don't with others, especially people I click with. I intrinsically want to spend more time with them. So I don't think it's, I haven't been extremely deliberate about that whole process. I'm much more deliberate about habits I try to instill to further those
but things. But have you had the same friends, the same people for a long time? Have you got fallen into it, or?
Yeah, no, I mean, I've tended to keep friends for a long time, personally.
Was it a measure of instant compatibility or circumstance or both? Or
I can't run an A/B test in my life, so it's hard to tell. Justin, co-founder of Justin TV and of Kiko before that, went to college with him, went to elementary school with him.
Oh my god.
Grew up in the same neighborhood. I don't think, you know, first employee of Justin TV, Jacob, known since I was two, like, it's not an accident. I don't think it's an accident that I have retained those friends, but it also wasn't on purpose. Like, I wasn't at four thinking, how do I create long-term relationships that will be beneficial to me later? I was thinking, like, I like this person and I want to, like, keep in touch with them. I don't know if there's a deep lesson to be learned there, really, but other than it's well worth taking the time to keep in touch with the people that you care about, which maybe that's just homespun wisdom everyone should know, right?
Yeah. I didn't mean to get distracted like this, but it was just pretty fascinating. But it brings us back to what I did want to get distracted with, which is the beginning of Twitch and Justin TV.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you just fall into Twitch? Or talk about the origin of Twitch.
Yeah, so we've been growing Justin TV, and Justin TV was still kind of growing, but it kind of leveled off. Like, it wasn't growing really fast anymore. And we were trying to figure out what to do next, because I think we all knew it's fine. Like, the company was stable and it wasn't like bleeding cash, so you could stay in that state for kind of indefinitely, but on the internet, if you're not growing, you're dying.
Yeah.
Like, because the companies that stop growing are targets for the ones for faster growing smaller companies that want to eat their customer base. And so it's not a good place to leave yourself for the long run. And we had a big debate internally, actually, about what the right next plan was, right? Because when you're in that situation, we sort of run out of faith that we could just continue to grow the same product in the same direction we've been doing it. And so we had a number of possible ideas for things we could tackle. One of them being gaming, but like also mobile, also enterprise, also, you know, social, and broadcasting or activity.
And were you a gamer?
I was a gamer. And the reason I got interested in the Twitch idea, which wasn't called Twitch at the time, I just thought of it as Justin TV Gaming, was the only content I really liked on Justin TV was the gaming content.
Mm.
That was the only content I really watched. And so I was like, I like this content, I think it's cool. That wasn't enough for me to want to start Justin TV Gaming. It was the clue. Right, I had this little niggling itch of curiosity about it, right? And I listened to that little. I was aware of that. Like, oh, that's interesting. That's the part I like and that I'm interested in. That's like maybe a good sign. And so then I started digging in. And I started looking at, okay, are there lots of people like me? Well, there's a ton of gamers, and they read a lot about video games, and they watch a lot of videos on YouTube about video games. Like, huh? Okay, so there are people who are interested in, like, not just games, but, like, learning about and connecting with media about games. That's a big thing. Advertisers like gaming. Advertisers are spending a lot of money against gaming content, like on IGN and companies like that. That's good. The content doesn't have massive rights issues because it's like radio. It's like back when music companies had a functional business model selling CDs and records. And the radio was an amazing promotional mechanism. Twitch today is in that position with game companies. We are an amplifier, a marketing amplifier for their functional business model selling video games. Right? Twitch would work much less well for the music industry, I think, because it's harder to see how the rights issues work out. Or the movie industry, for example. Because you're, to a much larger degree, reselling the same product. Whereas with gaming, you're an amplifier. And that was a big deal for us. And I sort of, you know, went down the checklist of, like, okay, these are good, this is a place, this meets all the criteria for things that should be good. But then, the next step for Twitch is what I was just talking about earlier, experimentation. We had all these theories about what would be good, and we thought the best two options were mobile and gaming. And so we decided to run an experiment. We said, we'll give each of them 6 months. We'll fund them both. We have our hypothesis, we can make them grow. So we'll set a bar, and if they're not above the bar, we kill them. And if they're both above the bar, if one of them's above the bar, we'll pivot. And if both are, we'll figure out what to do then. We'll probably spin one of them off. And so we did that. We ran the experiment. Okay, let's try it. Great. We have this whole theory about why gaming will be good, but the theory is irrelevant, right? What matters is, are you right? And when we tested it in the real world, it turned out, yeah, actually, that theory was borne out. I had a lot of other theories previous that had turned out not to work out. So
for every twitch and every niggle of a, you know, right. an idea, do you just try all of them? And for every 100, there's a twitch, or for every...
I don't think it's for every 100. I think you can improve the hit rate from there. But yeah, no. But then basically, yeah, you're gonna have good theories more often than you're gonna have actually good ideas. Mm. Like most. For every Dropbox that launched with approximately the right product from day one, there are dozens of companies that launched with not quite the right product on day one, right? It is more unusual for companies to launch to get it right on day one than it is for them to get it right on day 180. And that's because in the end, you're kind of guessing, and you're getting, if you hit the right thing, you know, day one, there's a lot of luck involved in that. I mean, also skill, because some people try a lot of times and never get anywhere. It's not just luck, but there's a good deal of luck that, like, you hit it right on the nose on the very first one. That's not all skill. Steve Jobs, one of the most famous product person in, you know, ever for the internet world, for technology, and he had plenty of bad ideas. You're not measured by how bad your bad ideas are. You're measured by how good your good ideas are. You had enough really good ideas that made up for it.
And so you're a thinker, you're a smart, thoughtful guy, you're young. How did you train yourself to be a CEO?
I did the job badly for a while, and then I started doing the job well. I think by well, I mean better than badly. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things you learn being a CEO is just how long and steep and forever the learning curve is, and how deep the depth of your ignorance about the correct course. There is anyone who tells you that they actually know the best. You make so many decisions as a CEO. You make so many decisions, most of which you never find out if you were right or wrong about. And most of which no one knows the right answer to, that are contextual, that are constantly changing as your market changes, as your company gets... Twitch has gone from 20 people to more than 200. And there's all these questions about how should we organize our teams, how should we do communication internally, that not only am I not sure we got the right answers to them before, whatever the answers were before, if they were right, they're not right now. And they won't be right in a year when we, you know, if we keep growing. And so, I think I've probably been a good CEO and a bad CEO, depending on this, you know, when you sampled the company. I've been doing The question is, being a CEO is not I think any sort of, you know, be good or bad. It's like successful or not successful. Either the aggregate of all the choices you make causes success or it doesn't. And I think I learned that I've learned things as a CEO, it's purely by the think hard, write down answers method. It's like, observe the apparent consequences of your actions and try to do better in the future.
And what about the people side of things? You mentioned briefly mild autism?
Mm-hmm.
Or was that where you're just being sarcastic?
I don't have autism. I mean, I'm definitely not self-diagnosing with autism in any way. There's sort of this autistic spectrum of, like, do you intrinsically, there's sort of traits that come along with autism. And I have some of them, when I read a description of someone with autism, especially when I was younger, I identified with a lot of them.
Talk about that trope, because there is something about that in startups where it's kind of glorified, or...
The traits that I identified with were easily overstimulated, difficulty... understanding someone else's emotional state of mind by looking at their face, difficulty maintaining eye contact, things like that. And as I got older, I kind of got over it. It was, you know, hit me a lot harder when I was younger. And as I've gotten, every year I think as I've gotten older, I've gotten better at learning it. And some of it's become muscle memory at this point. Some of it's still done intellectually, consciously, but I've learned better rules and I'm faster at it and I notice it better. And I think that, you know, the compensation for that was, I could be intellectual about it. I did learn many of the things about it that I, many of the interpersonal things that I think other people take for granted, naturally I had to learn, and thus, you know, I was forced to be thoughtful about them a little bit more from that age. But I think that, I think the interpersonal stuff, at least in startups, is actually, it's simple but hard. The only thing you have to do is, like, put yourself in the other person's shoes, understand their motivations and why they do, they make their, you know, how they see the world, and then explain things to them in their language. Like, be able to speak to them in the way that they will understand. And if you can do that, you kind of are successful. And that's like, I can explain it in one sentence or two sentences. It's really, really hard. I still fail at it regularly, but I think that's the heart of, you know, that's what's important interpersonally with employees. It's what's important interpersonally with customers, with vendors. If you can talk to them and see the world from their point of view, that's like the most single most important interpersonal skill you need.
As a CEO, from 20 people to 50 people to 100 people to 200, is your role always evolving?
Yeah, and your role evolves deeply in like these inherently new ways as the company grows that way. It also changes from month to month as the company's needs change, right? Mm. Oh, this month, you know, oh crap, I need to go raise money. I'm like raising money. It's completely different from this work I was doing a month ago, which is product, trying to figure out our product strategy versus, oh God, we have to hire. Versus, like, there's always some new crisis du jour as a CEO that like is now the most important problem for the company and now the thing you need to be working on.
And what attracts you to that kind of crisis lifestyle?
I get bored easily. And if you don't, if I have a job which is the same thing, too much the same thing day in and day out, I will become bored and like disinterested and want not be able to work on it at my peak capability anymore. So being CEO has suited me very well because I don't get bored.
What would you tell your 22-year-old self, or yourself that had just graduated college and in 2015, what would you tell yourself, what would you be doing?
You're doing basically the right things, but consider actually talking to your users and thinking about what they need. I don't know. The problem is, if you'd asked me at that age if I was doing that, I would have said yes, but I was not. I thought I was, but like, there is this moment, I think it happened when we were going through Twitch, I've talked about this in other interviews, where I realized, oh, I see, I go figure out who the most important users are, and I go talk to them, and I go learn what they actually need, and then I build stuff for them. Oh. And like, it was like before I'd been trying to assemble this piece of IKEA furniture in the dark, and I managed to assemble it, but it was kind of ugly and put together backwards. And then I had someone turn on the light switch, and I was like, and now assemble this chair. Like, oh, well, you mean I can just read the instructions? Like, I wasn't guessing anymore. It was amazing. And I wish I could, I spent maybe, in retrospect, 6 years bumbling around in the dark trying to do things without actually, like, understanding what I was doing. And I wish I'd figured that out a lot faster. So I think that's the number one thing I would have gone back in.
And would you, if you were 22 right now, would you, you know, try to start a company and go to Y Combinator? Or?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, the core thing I was doing at the time, which is like entering YC, starting a company with Justin, learning how to be a better programmer, learning how to be a better, you know, starting to learn how to be a manager, etc. Those were all the right things, and like, I don't know if there's any way to accelerate that process really.
Right, and you didn't miss, you know, working at like a Google or Facebook.
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's anything wrong with going to work for Google or Facebook, except that it's like really comfortable and you're likely to never leave. Right. So it's really important to you to start a company. You might want to consider doing it immediately. But I know a lot of people who very successfully gone and worked for a few years and then gone and started a company. That seems like a totally valid approach. I don't think there's any reason you need to do that. But I also don't think it's like bad. Yeah.
At Product Hunt, we're expanding to games. Mm-hmm. You know, we feature apps, websites, hardware. We were starting to hunt games, books, kind of all sorts of different content. And the first vertical we're expanding to is games. And that's literally the next like few weeks. And there's a lot of overlap in our audience already, but What advice broadly would you have, or concerns or thoughts for us?
Games are very different from other kinds of software. It's an extremely different industry that's much more like the movie industry than it is like the rest of the software industry. You spend a bunch of money. There's sort of two paths. You spend a bunch of money and you make a blockbuster that you then hope does really well, and you hope has bankable IP or bankable, the equivalent of a bankable star, like a bankable designer behind it, because otherwise you're putting a lot of money at risk and it might fail. Or you start from the indie path where you launch something quick and dirty for cheap, and there's just lots of people doing that all the time, and occasionally one of those will break through and become a big hit. Because of that, the whole structure of the industry is completely different. You've got it's structured like the movie industry, right? And whereas there's something of a science to how you do consumer internet products, I think it's a mistake to try to treat games that way. The companies that try to treat games like a science tend to fail over time.
Interesting.
I think it's a big mistake. Games are not science. Because fun is not yet science. Maybe someday, the company that figures out how to actually scientifically produce fun in a game will just destroy every other video game company. But no one has figured out how to... Right, the companies that are the best at it, like, I think Blizzard probably is one of the best companies in the world at just... Not necessarily the best company in the world at making video games, though they are certainly in the list of... You know, I think that's a debatable title.
Right.
But consistently, they do not make bad games. Right, like they just have the highest hit rate, and it's just like, and for the number of games they've released, without basically even their not successes are great games. Like the least successful Blizzard game is a great game, and I think that's because they're willing to just sort of like work and polish it until it's good. Which is like the opposite for way from, you came to me and told me you were going to run a consumer internet company the way Blizzard runs a consumer, the way Blizzard makes video games, I would tell you you're deranged. Like, there's no way that you should go work on a game in isolation for like 4 years or 5 years and then reveal it when it's beautiful and done. But that works great for video games if you have the time and resources to get it done. So I just think, you know, video games, all the rules are totally different.
And because like movies, it's hard to make MVPs, or it's hard to...
Yeah, exactly. The MVP of the game probably just isn't fun. Right? Like, it's probably just not good. It's hard to produce, like, an MVP for a startup can, like, produce that one quantum of utility. That, like, maybe it's broken in a lot of different ways, but it really hits that on the head. But the quantum of utility a game wants is that it's really fun. And that often doesn't come together until very late in the game's life cycle. It often takes many iterations to find, I think game designers call it finding the fun, as I've heard them call it that before. And it can often take many iterations to find the thing that makes it fun and polish it to the point where it's actually really enjoyable to play. And so that's just totally changes the nature of how you make games versus how you make, you know, internet stuff.
And so for us, what's attractive is that they're, compared to movies, you know, where there isn't as many released, and it's also harder to work with the people who make the movies, but you know, there's a lot of indie game makers who are looking to get their stuff out there. There's a lot of variability in game. Like, games are hot one day, they could be not. You know, there's a lot of games at launch. What are your thoughts on that?
I think the gaming industry is great because distribution is so easy now. Like, you distribute a movie, you still have to go to movie theaters.
Yeah.
You're seeing the same thing in games that you're seeing in music now, which is that anyone can get started, anyone can contribute, right? Minecraft was built originally by one person, and that's like how all game, you know, that's how the whole industry is moving now. And so I think that's exactly what makes it a good vertical for you guys, and why that makes sense is that you've got this type of software that actually, even more so than consumer software in some ways, one person can make a cool game and share it with the world. There's infinite demand for like reading about the new ones because like movies, there's, you know, this sort of constant flow of new interesting games. My concern would be there's a lot more competition for game news than there is competition for startup product news. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of startup product news stuff, but I think product time focused on a specific you know, we're doing launches well, like new stuff that product focused, which is really cool and new. Whereas no one in the games industry is confused about the difference between covering game companies and covering games.
Right.
And everyone wants to cover games because they're the cool thing. So you know, there's a lot more sites you can go to that have everyday coverage of game companies. I think the hard part there is differentiating yourself from other feeds of what's
right.
hot, you know, the hot new game.
Right.
Relatively speaking. I do think the product hunt format's gonna be kind of cool for that.
Yeah.
But that's if I were to guess, that's what I would worry about.
You are early 30s?
Yeah.
Kind of looking out as you think about, you know, Twitch has been immensely successful. You know, you're super focused on it right now. As you look far into the future, what do you think is going to drive you? Like, what do you think? What do you care about?
Continuing to have new. Like, for me, it's really very much the journey, not the destination. Someone asked me this recently about what makes me interested in my job. Like, why do I keep doing it? And I think for some people, they have a vision for a company they want to build. That like this product they want to bring into the world, but I'm not actually driven by that. I don't have any. I'm not bound to any specific necessary product thing I want to build. And I think actually being bound to that would take me away from being able to build the best possible thing. I enjoy the process. I like learning new things. I like management. I like product design. I like running the company. And so I intrinsically enjoy the journey, not just the destination. And so it's hard to say what, you know, where will I be in 15 years? Because if Twitch keeps growing and keeps offering new challenges, which so far there's zero sign it's going to stop, I'm going to be happy. And like, and you know, if it's still pushing me to learn and grow and try new things, then I'm going to enjoy that. I mean, I get to pick everyone I worked with, right? So it's great to be able to work with people you love, get new challenges every day, and you know, be part of this community that you know does this thing, this content you really love and like. It's gonna be hard for me to find the thing that beats Twitch as a product that I love working on.
I've gotten this question from you as we're expanding to games, and I don't even know how to answer it. But how are games fundamentally, inherently just good for people and for society? And how do you think about that?
I think to the degree that entertainment is good for society, games are good for society. I don't think they're any different from other. I think games are pretty much similar to other forms of entertainment in that there are some really important and interesting things games can teach you about the world.
Like movies and books?
Yeah, like movies and books. They're really fun. They're intrinsically pleasurable. Those are all good things. But I don't think that I don't think they're really that much different from other forms of media in the sense that, you know, there's both pluses and minuses. You can get too into a game,
right?
Just like you can get too into a movie or a book.
But no one ever gives books a bad rep, right?
I mean,
unless it's like Twilight or something.
If you go back in time, they did.
Interesting.
Right? Like it's only because books, now everyone's grown up with books. In 50 years, this won't be a debate anymore. Games are just going to be another category of media. Like, comic books were supposed to be corrupting our youth, right? Nobody's talking about that anymore.
Right.
Because they're not new anymore. People only talk about things corrupting the youth when they didn't grow up with them. Like, it's extremely unlikely that...
Interesting.
You'd have to be in a truly unusual circumstance for the new form of media that everyone who didn't grow up with them says are corrupting the youth to be actually a problem. Because that's happened so many times. Like, you just have to bet that, like, whatever the new form of media is that's supposed to be corrupting the youth, it probably isn't. That's unlikely.
Yeah, in a decade or whatever, it'll be VR.
So the VR games are going to be the thing that our generation doesn't like or something. I don't know, I think that's too transparently, obviously, not a...
Right.
Although, you know, maybe, I guess... I just find it hard to believe people keep making that mistake. Right? Like, isn't that mistake ridiculous? I can't understand the thought process that doesn't notice the pattern. Like, the pattern is really clear. Like, can't we learn from experience and just skip that this time?
Right.
Apparently not.
Well, on that note, Emmett, thank you for coming to our luxurious studio.
Thanks for having me. It's beautiful.
Yeah. And this was a fascinating, wide-ranging conversation. I think we did good.